That's it. Blame the one-armed man. He did it. He did it all.
You wanted this to happen. Planned for it, didn't you? That's why you modified the ship. You knew we'd have to land it.
We're the grid, James.
Don't give me that we're the grid nonsense. You have a cure for the regolith plague, don't you? In fact, I bet you created it.
We didn't, and we don't.
Liar.
There is no cure for the regolith plague.
How do you know?
Let's just say people as smart as you have been looking for it for a very long time.
What does that mean?
When you figure that out, you'll see the solution to your predicament. Not a cure, but a solution.
James slams a fist down on the workstation. Get out. Right now.
With a shrug, Arthur marches out of the bridge.
We are going to find a cure,
James says quietly. Izumi rises. I need to get back to work. Her first step is shaky. She teeters, and I catch her arm before she collapses. The weight on my bad leg sends a sharp pain through me. It ebbs when James scoops Izumi up in his arms.
I'm okay, she whispers. Put me down. It's just my blood sugar.
You're going to rest, James says, as he carries her toward the small bunk room off the bridge. On the screen, Min and Grigori stand.
We're coming.
You heard Izumi, I call to them as they're walking away from the camera. Min turns.
You need us, Emma. We're not staying here and waiting while you all die.
Chapter 46. James. I lead Arthur away from the ship, out into the forest where thick clouds still drift through. I don't want anyone else to hear this conversation. I sense that if I do get the information I need, it will be disturbing. Answers! Arthur shrugs. You're going to have to be more specific than that. What's the solution to the regolith plague? You've got all the pieces, James, and a mind you yourself don't even fully appreciate. Think about it. I turn and pace into the woods, considering what I know. I know the grid wanted us on Eos. It's the only reason they allowed us to leave Earth safely. It's the reason they saved the ship countless times on the way to Eos. If they had that power, they could have made Jericho arrive at the same time as Carthage. But they didn't. Carthage arrived first. They wanted that. They knew about the storms. They must have wanted the Carthage colonists to get sick, for me to chase the mystery. They reinforced Jericho, ensuring enough of it would survive re-entry and landing. All of this, Eos, the Jericho landing, the regolith plague, the grid planned it. You wanted this to happen. Want isn't the word. You need it to happen. Everything has led to this, hasn't it? What can I say, James? The universe is an equation with sadly far fewer variables than you imagine. You're going to have to be more specific than that. Arthur simply smiles at my repetition of his line. What could the grid possibly want with us? Why do you need us? That's the question, isn't it? On the Jericho, you said the grid once believed that matter and energy were the economy of the universe. That's why the grid was desperate to capture the output of every star. But you were wrong. You've recently discovered, what did you call it? A greater economy at work in the universe. Two forces infinitely more powerful, arrayed against each other. You said we're but dust motes floating above the battle. And that is the answer to the question. What are they, the two forces? Can't tell you. Why not? It's not how this works, James. You'll see. Soon. Can I save them? Emma? My children? The question isn't whether you can save them. It's whether you're willing to pay the price. A snapping branch draws my attention. I hope no one has hurt us. I hope even more that it's not an E-Rex. A cloud of fog floats by, revealing a single figure standing in the forest. Emma. Her face is a mask of confusion. She stares at Arthur and me a long moment, then says, "It's time."
Chapter 47. Emma. In the med bay, Sam eyes the stasis sleeve. James squats down to his eye level.
It's just for a little bit. It'll be like a nap,
over in a blink. Sam nods, face pained. He senses something is very wrong here. He's fared better than some of the other children. He could have waited longer to go into stasis. But the decision was made to keep families together, mainly in hopes that seeing their older siblings enter stasis first might help calm the nerves of the younger children. My sister-in-law, Abby, is holding Carson. I'm carrying Allie in my arms. Her weight is almost too much for me, but I cling to her anyway, knowing this might be the last time I ever hold my only daughter. She's burning up, in and out of consciousness. I kiss her cheek, my lips absorbing a salty tear. She opens her eyes in time to see Sam slip into the sleeve. It contracts, vacuuming tight to his body.
No, Mommy,
Allie whines. It's okay, sweetie. Her fingers dig into me as I hand her to James and his brother Alex. It's okay, I whisper in her ear as she jerks, clinging to me. I'm right here, I'm right here. Izumi touches a dispenser to her neck, and Allie's eyes close as her body falls limp. Thank you, I mouth to her, and she nods. Izumi is fading fast. I think it's more than the regolith plague that's affecting her. It's the pressure and fatigue, knowing she's our only chance and that time is slipping away. James holds Carson, kisses his forehead, then hands him to me. I press my lips to his burning flesh and gently place him in the sleeve. I know I need to keep it together, but I can't. I break, a sob escaping as the bag seals around him. Tears run down my face. James wraps an arm around me and pulls me into a hug. Behind me, my brother-in-law, David, says, Come on, Owen, you're up. He bends and hugs my nephew, who's also putting on a brave face. What I feel most right now is the absence of my sister, like a limb that's been chopped off, and I just now realized it when I tried to stand on it and fell. Emotionally, I'm on the floor, and I feel like I can't get up. I want to hug Owen and his sister Adeline and tell them that their mother is looking down on them and she's proud of them and she loves them very much. I try, but the words won't come. My throat seems to close up. I just hug them until David pulls them from my arms and puts them in the stasis sleeves. Alex and Abby's daughter Sarah is next. If Jack were alive, he would be with them, waiting to go into stasis. I feel his absence hanging over us, a reminder of just how deadly this disease is and what it has already cost us. James grips his brother's shoulder as he passes his daughter into stasis. We exit as fast as we can. Time is our most precious commodity now. Every moment we linger in the medbay is another second someone has to survive until they're put in stasis. Many of my fellow colonists have only seconds left. Time is running out for all of us. Grigori, Min, and the others from Carthage City are here now, mostly helping to carry and stack the stasis sleeves and remove the dead from the makeshift hospital. Abby, Alex, David, James, and I set about working in the hospital, distributing fluids and anti-inflammatories, and helping people to the bathroom. This ship has one toilet, and it was made for space, not terrestrial habitation, so we've had to set up outhouses, which have the advantage of letting people get fresh air. Like everything else in our lives at the moment, we're improvising, making the best of it. For the next few hours, I try to visit as many colonists as I can. I place my hands on theirs and tell them we're doing everything we can. At the end of the aisle, James is holding a water bottle up to an older woman's lips. He smiles at me, a weary, warm smile that lights me up inside. And then he turns his head and coughs. His forehead is covered in beads of sweat. When he moves toward the next bed, I walk down the aisle and catch his arm. You're sick. No, I'm not. It's just stuffy in here. He tries to pull away, but I hold him tight. James! Come on. We've got work to do. For the next hour, we resume helping the sick. Finally, I ask him, Are you sure this is what you should be working on? As in? As in, to quote Arthur, there is no cure, but there is a solution. What were you two talking about in the forest?
To be honest, I haven't quite figured out what we were talking about. Yet.
He moves on to the next bed. And when we're back out in the aisle, he continues. This helps me clear my mind.
It's given me some perspective on our problem.
What are you thinking?
I'm thinking all of this. The storms, the Regolith plague, the downed ship. It's all related.
Related? How?
Somehow, it all leads back to the Eye of the Grid. The diagram we found at Carthage City is actually a map of Eos. At the end of the arcs, I found hollow spheres buried in the snow.
I stop in the aisle and face him. That's what you've been looking for on the dark side.
Yes.
What was inside?
The spheres? Nothing. One curious thing, though. As the arc moves up the eye, the spheres get smaller.
What does that mean? Maybe they were inside each other? James breaks eye contact, that mind of his turning the possibility over like a child encountering a new toy. I can almost see the wheels turning. We walk in silence, James thinking. A few minutes later, his eyes go wide.
Huh.
Huh, what?
Nothing.
Were the spheres inside of each other?
Not exactly, but in a way, yes.
And it's the key.
Chapter 48. James. When I figured it out, I practically ran out of the ship, kept running down its length until I was out of earshot of anyone. And then I threw up, and threw up some more, until my stomach was empty and I was gasping for air. Now I'm leaning against the hull, feeling the cold metal on my boiling skin. The fever has been getting worse by the hour. I'm infected, I'm almost sure of it. But I might have figured it all out in time to help us. I can see Arthur under a tree. Grigori sitting nearby with a rifle. Grigori's insisted on standing guard around Arthur. He doesn't trust him. I can't say I blame him. The grid killed the woman he loved. Feeling all right, James? Arthur calls to me with mock concern. I ignore him. Grigori, I need to speak to Arthur. Speak, Grigori says, not taking his eyes off his prisoner. Alone. Bad idea. Grigori, please, he's not going to hurt me. Eyeing Arthur, I add, he needs me, and they need you in the ship. They're loading the adults. Grigori mutters in Russian, no doubt unpleasant words, but he treks back to the ship. Want me to translate? Arthur asks mildly. I motion to the woods. Go. Feeling the heat? Arthur asks, as we move deeper into the damp, quiet forest. The Regolith plague is airborne, isn't it? Communicable from person to person. Very. I'm guessing we're all infected at this point? You're guessing correctly. Here's another guess. The grid made the spheres. Arthur is silent. His face is a mask. You don't want me to find them because they're the key, aren't they? If I found them too soon and put it together, it might throw off your plan. Is that one of those very few variables in this great cosmic equation? Yes. Very good. And I figured out that equation, by the way. The two forces greater than matter and energy. It's simple, really. If matter is accelerated to the speed of light, it becomes energy. The grid assumed once it gathered all the energy and converted all the mass, it would control all the energy in the universe. You thought you'd control the cycle. If we assumed there was nothing in the beginning, and that there was a big bang and a release of energy and matter at that beginning, it's logical to assume that whoever or whatever controls all the energy can restart the cycle and control the universe. But it's not that simple, is it? Nothing ever is. As you said, there's something operating on a level completely above it. There always is. Two fundamental forces, and a battle that stretches from the beginning of the universe to the end. Forces greater than matter and energy. Took me a while, but it was obvious once I figured out the spheres. Those two forces are space and time. Yes. The grid was in the spheres, wasn't it? Larger and larger versions of the grid in each sphere, older versions. Correct again. Why are they here on this planet? I can't tell you that. Because it might harm you. That's why you didn't want me looking for them. Somehow you're in danger, too. Not in as much danger as you, James. You're getting sicker every minute we waste talking about this. So are your people. Put them in stasis, and I'll give you answers. Real answers. The kind that just might save your species.
You'll tell me now, or I'll take you apart.
You could, but you still wouldn't find what you're looking for. The data you want, the truth of what's happening here, is stored on a data device somewhere close by, with a trusted source. The spheres are the key to everything, James. The story of why and how they came to be here will reveal the fate of your species. I'll give you the information you need, but only once they're all in stasis. Everyone. It's their only chance.
Chapter 49. Emma. All but 12 colonists are in stasis now. We've stopped the clock on their disease progression, but we have other problems. The Jericho was fully charged in orbit. Now its solar cells are cracked and damaged, and its power reserves are being drained. Without power, we can't sustain the stasis system. Everyone dies. In a way, we're in the same place we were in that warehouse in Camp 9. Without power, our species ends. It seems, for us, it all comes back to power. We've made a decision, the only one we could make. Everyone but James and Grigori will go into stasis. They'll reassemble a 3D printer and repair the solar cells. They're both sick, like everyone now. But neither James nor Grigori were in the cave. They seem to be faring better. And if they become unable to work, they'll get the next shift out of stasis and give them their orders. A desperate relay race for survival. Izumi has nearly worked herself to death. Min has argued with her constantly. Finally, mercifully, she's given up. For now. The plan is to bring her out of stasis after the power situation is solved, and allow her to continue looking for a cure. That seems to be our only hope. One thing, however, strikes me as strange. James. I expected him to be working like a madman, frantically trying to discover whatever solution Arthur alluded to. Instead, I find him outside, looking up at the red dwarf star in the sky. I'm going with Grigori and Min to collect more solar cells from Jericho City. Want to join us? He shakes his head. I have a better idea. Gin Rummy. He takes my hand and leads me toward the ship, onto the bridge, and to the small table where we played cards when Jericho was en route to Eos. Are you sure you're feeling okay? He smiles. Other than some mysterious alien fungal disease, yeah, I'm fine. Come on, I'll deal. His mood is somber, but he's more talkative than usual, reminiscing about the past, our brushes with death, and those we've lost. It's as if he thinks these are our last moments together. James, he peeks over his cards. Can I ask you something? Anything. Have you given up? You know me better than that. Have you figured it out? What Arthur was saying? The solution to all of this? I'm close. You don't seem concerned. I'm not. You shouldn't be. Let's enjoy this moment as if it was our last. Is it? Not if I can help it. When the teams are finished gathering the pieces of the solar cells, Brightwell directs her troops and the remaining civilians to enter stasis. When they're gone, only our leadership team is left awake. James, Grigori, Izumi, Min, Brightwell, and myself. We've decided to have a final meal together, since we'll be on different shifts from here out. At least until the crisis is over. Brightwell is the only invitee who declined. I'm going downhill fast, she said, as if reading the weather. I may need the time I have left on the other side of stasis. In the med bay, she marches directly toward the stasis sleeve, but James stops her and shakes her hand. You kept us safe, Colonel. You didn't do so bad yourself, sir. I should have listened to you at Warehouse 412. That was a world ago, sir. Alex and Abby enter stasis next, James shares a long hug with his brother, whispering in his ear, "I'm sorry about Jack." Tears form in both their eyes. I reach over and put my arms around Abby and hug her tight. They go bravely into the stasis sleeves, staring up at us until the bags seal them away. When they're gone, only James, Grigori, Min, Izumi, and I are left outside of stasis. We gather on the bridge for dinner, as we did on the day we arrived here. We pick through the MREs, everyone pulling out their favorites like death row inmates splurging on a final meal. That's what the mood feels like. Grigori is resigned, barely saying a word. Min hugs Izumi tight to him with one arm, eating with the other. James and I lean on each other and talk quietly, about the kids and things they loved, and saying things like, "It's not that bad. Things were so much worse. After the battle with the Beta artifact, at Ceres, in the Citadel, at Warehouse 903. But in every one of those situations, we had a fighting chance. We didn't sit around and reminisce as the darkness closed in around us. This is different. We all sense it." James raises his glass. "I'd like to propose a toast. To Lena, Charlotte, Harry, and Fowler." He pauses. "We couldn't have gotten here without them." After the meal, the group breaks up. Grigori stalks off deep in thought. Arthur is nowhere to be seen, likely because Grigori might kill him for any reason he can find. Min and Izumi retreat to the bunk room, holding each other. James insists we play one more game of gin rummy. "Are you sure?" I ask. "We could play poker, but with two people."
"James, you're almost scaring me. What's going on? What's going to happen?"
"I don't know exactly. What I do know, what I've come to believe, very recently, is that things happen for a reason."
"Okay. How does things happening for a reason help us right now?"
"What if I told you there was a greater force at work in the universe?"
"Such as?"
"Such as something operating at a level we can't fully understand now, but we might soon."
"If you said that, I would be very worried."
He laughs, an untroubled, hearty laugh. "That's fair, but I'm coming around to the idea, because in a way, the idea that there is something larger going on in this universe makes far more sense than there being nothing."
"Are you having some kind of breakdown? Is it the Regolith plague?"
"No. Well, I don't think so."
"Do you know something you're not telling me?"
"Right now, there's only one question that matters. In the whole world." He stares at me, a smile forming on his lips, his eyes caring and confident. Like the first time I ever saw him. "Do you trust me?"
"Completely."
In the med bay, Izumi goes into stasis first. She's the sickest. Then Min, and finally I'm lying on the table, inside the sleeve, peering up at James. Grigori steps out of the room, giving us privacy. "I'll see you in a few minutes," James says as he leans down to kiss me.
"You promise?"
"I promise."
Chapter 50. James. When Emma's stasis sleeve seals, I check and recheck the system status, ensuring it's functioning properly. Next, I ransack the med bay, looking for the item I require. For a moment or two, I was afraid they'd all been used. Thankfully, Grigori enters a few seconds after I find it. "We have work," he says, turning on his heel and heading for the door. I take two long steps, wrap an arm around his chest, and jab the injector into his neck. He spins, throwing me off, staring at me in horror. "James, what?" He staggers and falls, too fast for me to catch. I dive, but his head hits hard. His eyes are glassy. Panicking, I check his pulse. It's there, steady. I slide my arms under him and hoist him up onto the table and into the waiting stasis sleeve. I key the sequence as quickly as possible. When I see the system check flash green, I breathe a sigh of relief. The sound of Arthur's voice makes me jump. That was a little dicey. I didn't have a choice. I couldn't exactly explain, especially since I don't fully understand it myself. True. So where shall we start? As I said, I want to see the beginning. What the eye saw. Very well. Can you put it on the view screen? We have something else in mind. Footsteps echo in the corridor. Impossible. Everyone is in stasis. A small E-Rex? Another predator? I scan the medbay for anything I could use as a weapon. The energy weapon lies nearby. It's charged. I'm about to reach for it when Arthur says, "Relax. We're all friends here. Family, you could say." Oscar appears in the doorway, his face a placid reflection of Arthur's arrogant expression. "Hello, sir." "Oscar." "I told you the data was with a trusted source," Arthur says. "Trip okay, cuz?" "Without issue," Oscar replies. "You two have been in contact?" I ask. "Of course," Arthur says. "Constantly. He was really worried about you, by the way."
"We would have seen a ship in orbit."
"We're the grid." I close my eyes and nod wearily. "Yes, I know, you're the grid, and you can hide your ships, and you probably lied about your transmission range and who knows what else." "Pretty much covers it," Arthur says.
"Let's get on with it. I want to see everything the Eye of the Grid saw, from the very, very beginning."
"This isn't a home movie, James." Arthur eyes me with a smile. "Though I would love to see the look on your face when you realize what's really going on here."
"If it's not a movie, what is it?"
"Call it an experience."
"VR?"
"Sort of." Arthur nods to an empty stasis sleeve. "You go in, and we'll show you."
"No way."
"Why not?" Arthur says, annoyed.
"Well, frankly, I was thinking it would be good to be conscious when I figure out what's going on. You know, just in case you're going to screw me over or kill all of my people, as you've shown a tendency to try to do since we first met you."
"Sir," Oscar says, "you have my word. I'll protect you, like you protected me when they were trying to find me." For a moment, I look back and forth between Oscar and Arthur. They're like two sides of a coin. Jekyll and Hyde. Can Oscar protect me?
Arthur is a military prototype, stronger and faster than Oscar. But Oscar has two arms to Arthur's one, so I give him the edge. Besides which, I have to wonder, what other choice do I have?
"Are you in or out?" Arthur says, acting bored.
"I'm in."
As the stasis sleeve closes around me, and the gas enters my lungs, I wonder if I've made the right choice. If not, it will be the last choice I ever make. Chapter 51. James. I expect to see Eos when I open my eyes. My assumption is that things started here. What I see instead is my childhood home, near Asheville, North Carolina. I'm using a screwdriver to take the training wheels off Alex's bike, then pushing him down the driveway, cheering him on, watching as he wobbles and loses control, the bike careening into the side of the red brick columns at the beginning of the driveway. I bound forward, running so hard my lungs ache. I scoop him up in my arms and hold him tight as he screams. The image dissolves, and I'm walking in the backyard, toward the woods behind the house, a paintball gun in my hand. At the edge of the grass, I hear a pop. My abdomen explodes in pain. I fall to my knees and almost retch. From the tree line, Alex emerges, holding his own paintball gun.
"You were supposed to hide in the woods," I yell. "I was in the woods."
The next memory is from college, at a party in Dave Cardenia's cramped apartment. A Lynyrd Skynyrd song is playing too loud to talk over, nearly too loud for me to think straight. I'm holding a red plastic cup full of beer, my fourth. That's not helping me think straight either. It is, however, aiding my courage, which I've just decided to deploy. Her name is Olivia Lloyd. She's wearing jeans and a white button-up shirt, untucked. Her black hair, which is pulled into a ponytail, matches the black-rimmed glasses she wears. She breaks from the group of four girls she's been chatting with all night and weaves through the packed apartment, making her way to the line waiting for the bathroom. I can't take my eyes off of her. As she passes by me, she cocks her head, giving me a wry, devil-may-care smile that silently says, "What are you staring at?" Now or never. In my mind's eye, I see myself nonchalantly wading through the crowd and slipping into line behind her.
In reality, it's a mad scramble, squeezing behind people, clutching my beer to my chest, and holding it over my head to avoid spilling it, shouting, "Heads up!" and "Can I get by?" I arrive at the line, queuing up behind Olivia a second before another guy gets there. She turns, eyes me, the smile returning. "Hey!" I yell over the chorus of Tuesday's Gone. "Hey! You're in Chandler's physics class, right?" "Yeah. He's pretty weird. Yeah, he's a freak." I take a sip of beer, mentally preparing myself for the line I've mentally rehearsed 6.8 million times. "I was thinking..." "What?" She leans closer, trying to hear. "I said, I was thinking we could study together sometime." "What? Do you want to study sometime for the midterm?" She leans back, the smile growing as she shakes her head. "No! You don't want to study with you!" My face flushes. I don't know if it's the beer or the embarrassment, but I feel like I could pee my pants. If I had magical powers and I could disappear, I would. I'd go anywhere. But as awkward as standing here is, I think taking off at this moment would be even weirder. I'm trapped. Mercifully, it's a very short line. Olivia's next up. At least there's that. Light at the end of the tunnel. The door to the bathroom opens, and a girl and a guy shuffle out laughing, their faces as flushed as mine. The song ends, and the agony of silence sets in. I gaze at the ceiling, studying the cracked drywall, wondering if I will ever feel normal again, or what passes for normal for me. Olivia doesn't go to the bathroom. She peeks around me, at the other guy in line who's chugging beer.
"Go ahead!"
"You sure?" he asks, already heading for the bathroom, unzipping his pants.
"I'm sure,"
she mutters, watching him go before turning to me.
"Were you trying to ask me out?"
"What? No!" "Call Me the Breeze" is starting up, the lyrics drowning out my voice, which, unhelpfully, is getting fainter.
"I mean, I was... I... we... could... to study for a test." "Because, for reference, I would have said yes to that."
My brain feels as sharp as the plastic cup I'm holding. It's like I'm staring at letters from a Scrabble game, trying to assemble words on the fly.
"You... to asking you out."
She throws her head back and laughs.
"Yes, me, to asking me out. I'd say yes. Are you asking me out?"
I nod, half mesmerized, maybe a little drunk.
"I'm definitely asking you out."
"I'm definitely saying yes."
"Cool."
The bathroom door opens and the guy stumbles forward. Olivia pauses in the doorway.
"We can start going out right after I'm done."
"I'll be here."
She was far and away the most interesting person I ever met, and the smartest. She had a passion for life and a deep interest in so many disparate subjects. Physics, nature, politics, you name it, she was fascinated by it. She was constantly researching some new subject and telling me about it. The biggest impact she had on me was changing the way I looked at the world. She took nothing at face value, nothing she heard, nothing said on the news, nothing written in the paper. If a topic interested her, she would do a deep dive into it. Books, articles, research. She would even call up experts in the field and pepper them with questions, insisting she was a college student doing research and needed their input. I just stared or shook my head. I think during those years in college, she really didn't know what she wanted to be or what interested her. Mentally, she was trying things on. But it wasn't a casual pursuit for her. She believed that if you were going to have an opinion about an important topic, you'd better know it top to bottom before you opened your mouth. And when she did, she was sure of what she was saying. She had a mind like a steel trap. She could cite the facts to back up what she said, line and verse. In the classes we shared, I watched her demolish professors like a dump truck rolling over a kid's play toy. In the vortex that was a debate with her, she could literally shape your reality. Offer facts that changed your entire perspective on a problem and the world around it. It was incredible, and in a way, intoxicating. She was a walking, talking reality distortion field. She was becoming an activist even then. Under pseudonyms, she penned op-ed pieces that were widely read, shared, and contested. She reveled in it. At her core, she had a simple belief. If you're right about something, that gives you the authority to act on it, to stand and not back down. The consequences don't matter. The world will catch up eventually. In a way, I internalized that belief, and it led to my own problems later. To say I fell in love with her would be an understatement. I was like a boy walking along on a lazy afternoon, whistling on my way to go fishing, and falling down an abandoned well. It happened that fast. In the blink of an eye, I was in so deep, there was no way out. That Christmas, I took her home to meet my parents. They loved her. Alex, who was still in high school, adored her. Her parents were divorced. She had a troubled relationship with her father, who was a civil rights lawyer. Her relationship with her mother wasn't much better. The two of them were more like old friends who had once been close but now just kept in touch out of habit. When I asked her about it, she said it was because her mother was obsessed with her research at the NIH. But the truth was, Olivia wasn't making much effort either. As I soon learned, she had problems of her own. Being with her was like a roller coaster. She was either up or down, and she switched violently, unexpectedly. In those days and weeks, I hung on for dear life. During her bouts of depression, she was nearly despondent. Nothing interested her. Nothing mattered. And then out of nowhere, the fog would lift, and she would come back to life as if it had never happened. I begged her to go to student health, but she wouldn't hear of it. "I might as well get a lobotomy," was her response. By my junior year of college, I had a vague idea of what I wanted to do with my life. Be with her and practice medicine. I'd gotten into medical school and had been pressing her about her plans. I knew we were too young to get married. She would never go for it. But I desperately wanted to stay with her. "I know what I'm going to do," she announced one night at her apartment. "For, with my life." "Oh, that. The next World Foundation." "I'm not familiar." "You wouldn't be. It's new. I formed the legal entity today."
"Practicing law now, too?"
"Not quite. I used an online legal service to file the articles of incorporation with the California Secretary of State. Pretty easy, actually. I'm now the founder and sole director of a newly formed nonprofit organization."
"Wow. Should I call you CEO or Madam Director now? Or..."
She waves a hand. "Don't be so grandiose. Architect and Master of Human Destiny will suffice."
"Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
You get used to it."
"What exactly will the Next World Foundation do?"
"Unite the world."
"Is that all?"
"I'm serious."
"Of that I have no doubt. Details, please."
"It's simple. Right now, human civilization is building a world where the vast, vast majority of people have no place. We have the first world, composed of developed, mostly consumer-driven economies with advanced technologies and stagnating population growth. And we have the third world, where the population is exploding and people still live the way they did 10,000 years ago, for the most part. All of these people are living on the same planet, a planet with only so much land, so much water, and so much food. In short, there is a limit to how many people Earth can support. Without intervention, at some point, the population of the third world will require all the planet's resources. However, the first world has the ability to protect those resources, which it also needs. This does not end well." Like so many times before, she's framed the debate in a way I never thought of.
"That's a complicated problem."
"One with a simple solution. Integration."
"How?"
"Besides natural resources, there's only one thing the third world has that the first world needs. Consumers."
"But those consumers have a fraction of the buying power and economic value of first world consumers."
"That's true today, but it's going to change. Right now, somewhere in the third world, a genius is being born. And by the time I finish this sentence, another's been born. They are their people's best hope of a better future. The problem is, we don't know who they are. If we did, think about what we could do. What if a group of multinational corporations, knowing that growth in the third world is critical to their long-term success, donated to Next World? We're not talking about a lot, a few million a year, a drop in the bucket in their charity budgets. But if you had 100 companies doing it..."
"It adds up."
"Yes. With that money, we could partner with education departments around the world to identify gifted individuals and educate them in our best schools. Most of these kids will go off to bigger and better things, but some will go back home. Those kids are their homeland's greatest hope of joining the First World.
And what do these companies get? You know that's their first question.
Besides the positive press, they get to play a role in the lives of the future leaders of the Third World. Every Next World Scholar will receive a free education. In return, they commit to a 2-year internship with one of the Next World donors, any of the 100 companies. They choose. As I said, I believe most will do their 2 years and then go off and do whatever they want. Some, however, will stay with the company. The companies will likely send these bright young people back to their homelands to open new offices and expand their existing presence there. They will be the best of both worlds, the key to the company's growth initiatives and to their country's ability to catch up to the First World. In a generation, the world can change.
It's brilliant. Simple, achievable, huge potential.
She beams at me.
I think so, too. Where do we even start?
My mind is racing.
Maybe get some of the professors to join the board, or as advisors. They could make the introductions to some corporations that might donate.
I've already sent a few emails.
What else? I guess we'll need some sort of aptitude test.
Therein lies the key to the whole program. There have been initiatives similar to Next World in the past. They succeed on a small scale, but their shortcoming begins with scholar selection. Their criteria are too one-dimensional. Raw intelligence and problem-solving. The ability to excel at standardized tests isn't always the best predictor of future success. Think about the people you grew up with. Sure, those at the top generally went on to excel in life, but, at least at my high school, there were tons of people outside the top 5% who were a whole lot better at life and the real world than school. They had things traditional tests don't measure. Common sense, drive, and in a word, heart. We need to find those kids.
You're right. We need a whole new kind of test. We'll need a learning expert, maybe a psychologist, career experts. The test will need to be translated. What else? We'll have to identify the schools they'll attend. The scholarship recipients will have to learn English, I assume.
James? When I look up, Olivia's smile is gone. This is going to be my life's work.
Okay, I'm going to help you.
No, you're not.
You're going to need a lot of help.
I will, but this isn't for you.
What?
I can't do this and be with you.
I shake my head, confused. I don't understand. I can help you.
You can, but this is the path I'm choosing. I don't want you to just follow me.
What if supporting you is my path?
That's exactly my point. If you join me in this, you're never going to figure out what you truly love. Your own path. You deserve that. I won't take it from you.
Look, I'm not asking you to marry me.
She winces at the word, and I can't help but smile.
I just want to volunteer at your nonprofit.
We can't just be co-workers.
Why not?
You know why. We're right for each other. You balance out my ups and downs. You're as solid as the Rock of Gibraltar.
I fail to see how this is a bad thing.
If I'm around you, I'll be with you, and I'll change my life for you, for what you want. I know it. You're the kind of guy girls go home to, the guy with a manicured lawn and 3 kids. I don't know if I want that. My home life growing up, it was not great. I don't know what I want for myself. I just know I want to do this work. Maybe if we'd met each other later in life.
In typical Olivia fashion, she's thought long and hard about it. Her mind is made up, and the debate is a crushing defeat for the other side. My side. The side of staying together.
The conversation ends with one more surprise. She leans forward and kisses me. Long and deep, as if she hasn't seen me for a year. It's a lot of hurt now, James. But it would be a lot more hurt later.
I nod, still barely able to believe we're breaking up.
One thing won't change, she says, lips almost touching mine. I love you. I always will.
She reaches down, grasps her Stanford t-shirt, lifts it over her head, unsnaps her bra, and begins feverishly ripping my clothes off. We don't bother moving to the bedroom.
In some ways, the pleasure dulls the pain of the sadness. It takes my mind off of it, at least.
That was my first real taste of heartache. Despite the hurt, ours wasn't an abrupt breakup.
It was gradual. We still had lunch and dinner together, talked like nothing had ever happened, made love 3 times per week, then 2, then once, and then only occasionally. 2 people drifting out of each other's lives. And I did feel adrift, thrown overboard, barely afloat, watching the ship of my dreams sail past the horizon, never to return. My life turned then. I drew inward. I'd always been a shy child, mostly because of the stutter. I got over my speech impediment, but I never changed. I threw myself into school and returned to what was perhaps my first love, reading. It was an escape, a way to distract my mind while my heart healed. The other thing I learned is that time only heals so much. I was different after that. Maybe it was the science fiction I was reading, and the transhuman movement, or all the evil in the world. But for whatever reason, I turned my focus to robotics. In some small way, I think it was because a human had hurt me so badly, so unexpectedly. A robot can't do anything it's not programmed to do. And I was the programmer, in total control. A robot couldn't hurt me the way she had. Investing myself in that seemed safer to me. In my 2nd year of medical school, I began working on Oscar. It took me 10 years to complete him. I dated, but never really connected with anyone. Subconsciously, I think I compared them to Olivia. And in truth, I'd never gotten over her. That's what made what happened next so unbearable. In the memory, I'm standing in line, dressed in a suit, shuffling forward every few seconds. Olivia's mom hugs me. Her father is dry-eyed, handshake firm as he grips my elbow and moves me along. All business, that one. The picture of Olivia on the casket must be recent. She's standing in a jungle, her arm around someone who's been cut out of the picture. Her face is tanned and slightly lined, but she still has the same smile I saw that night at the keg party. A truly unique combination of devious and caring. It was a quick death. A plane crash in Bangladesh. I can't help thinking about how my life would have been different if she and I had traveled that path together. I always thought that a part of me was buried with her. My ability to love like that. I did lose it for years, and it awakened again when I least expected it. During the long winter, when I met Emma. I felt that same spark the instant I saw her. She has Olivia's passion for life, maybe even a little more. They're alike in many ways, though Emma doesn't have the darkness Olivia fought. But the thing that's truly different about the two of them is that when our life hit a fork in the road, Olivia ran away, whereas Emma grabbed my hand. And she has every time. There isn't even a second thought. When we face a challenge, Emma reaches out to me. Olivia pushed me away. She always would have. At heart, she was a lone wolf. Emma's a partner. I can see that now. And I've realized what these memories represent. The most painful moments of my life. I know what's next. My most painful memory. I will it not to happen. But the memory starts. My father's study is lined with bookcases, stained a light gray. I sit on the couch in the bay window, Alex beside me staring at the floor. My father's words come in clips and phrases. Not operable. Nothing else to it. Not going to do that. A dignified death. I'm as stunned as when Olivia ended our relationship. Outside, Alex walks me to my car.
Tell me you're going to do something.
Like what?
Get him in a trial for some new medicine.
You heard him. He won't do it.
He would if Mom were still alive.
Probably so.
You've got to do something, please.
And I did do something. A mistake. A miscalculation that changed my life forever. Oscar, 4 of my brightest lab assistants and I, worked day and night, racing the clock, knowing my chance was slipping away. The next memory's in the hospital, standing with Alex and Abby in a room where Dad lies in bed asleep. A machine charting his vitals. Oscar's outside in the hallway, watching.
Well?
Alex asks. I can save him, I reply.
How?
Do you trust me? Alex nods.
Of course.
In the next memory, I'm back in the lab, ushering Alex and Abby in. This is a new beginning. Hearing the words again makes me wince, knowing what comes next. Today we make history. We'll never have to say goodbye to Dad, ever. I tap a button on my tablet. Behind me, the prototype sits up. I didn't have time to make it look the way I wanted, but it functions. What is this? Alex asks. Abby bunches her eyebrows, concerned. I turn my back to them and face the prototype. How do you feel?
Fine. James, how did I get out of the hospital?
We'll discuss that soon enough, Dad. Right now, I need to run a diagnostic. A crash sounds behind me. I spin and find Alex lying on the floor. He stumbled backwards over some of my lab equipment. Abby is shaking her head, looking terrified.
What have you done?
Alex screams. I hold up my hands. I know it seems crazy, but this is going to be commonplace very soon. People with terminal illnesses don't have to die anymore.
You put Dad in that thing?
It's a body.
It's an abomination!
Alex practically runs from the lab, Abby close behind him. Memories of the aftermath follow. FBI agents pour into my lab, take me into custody, and deactivate my creation. Oscar watches from a wide window in the conference room as they take me away. They take my passport and tag me with an electronic locator, but they let me out on bail. There's only one thing on my mind, contacting Alex. He won't take my calls, won't see me. There's only one person left in my life, and I focus on protecting him. I hire a small law firm to set up a company that I use to buy a rundown ranch north of San Francisco, just outside Petaluma. The small house on the property is far from the nearest road. Grass long ago reclaimed the dirt driveway. I instruct the firm to use my savings to pay any costs that may arise, which I expect will be minimal. Oscar and I load the van and travel there at night. Inside the home, I open the door in the kitchen and lead him down the creaking staircase to the cellar. You have your charging adapter?
Yes, sir.
The law firm will pay the utilities. The power should stay on. If it doesn't, go into total suspension.
I understand, sir.
Under no circumstances are you to broadcast anything or to leave the cellar for any reason.
Of course. What will happen, sir?
I don't know. There's never been a trial like this. If I'm exonerated, I'll come and get you. If not, I don't know what sort of sentence I'll receive. Could be months or even years. I'll come for you when I'm out, I promise. But for however long it is, I need you to wait.
A minute? A month? A million years? I'll wait, sir. Time doesn't touch me.
I envy you that, Oscar. In the courtroom I'm standing, watching the judge as he says the words, "Life without the possibility of parole." The phrase runs through me like a ghost that rips away my soul, leaving me numb. Unlike Oscar, time does touch me. At Edgefield Federal Correctional Institution, each year is like a wave washing over me, peeling a layer away, a piece of me gone forever. In the laundry room, I fold the sheets and watch the news, waiting for the long winter to begin. There are riots in Barcelona, Athens, and Rome, the populace rising up against the budget cuts brought on by austerity. There's talk of civil war. The years flow by. Gray hairs sprout at my temples and wrinkles reach across my face, time carrying them. In the next memory, I look in the mirror and see a lined face that's older than mine is now. I peer out the window at the grassy yard, at an earth that was never decimated by the long winter. I realize the truth then. These aren't my memories.
Chapter 52. James. In the memories, time marches by in flashes. Before, I was reliving the memories as if watching them. Now I'm experiencing them. This life I didn't live but could have. That someone just like me did experience. At Edgefield, in my spare time, I search the internet for any news on Alex, Abby, Jack, or Sarah. I find only tidbits, and I drink them in like drops offered to a man stranded in the desert. The lines on my face run deeper, my hairline retreats, the world disintegrates.
Every major government except for those of the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, and China defaults on their debt. The global economy plateaus and then starts a long, slow decline with no solution. Because the problem isn't the economy. It's the people. Robots do the manual labor. Cars drive themselves. Homes clean themselves. Roof tiles capture solar energy, which powers the cars, the home, and the devices everyone is glued to. Life is comfortable. And as long as it doesn't get worse, no one tries to make it any better. In a small town in Cameroon, 200 people get sick. It's believed at first to be Ebola. They later name it Milong Fever, after the town where it started. The story is in the news one day and forgotten the next. A week later, there are cases of Milong Fever in every nation in the world. 3 billion are infected. 400 million die. Then things really fall apart. No one wants to leave their home. The threat of a second wave of outbreak is ever present. Virtual reality becomes the largest industry in human history. The hardware market skyrockets, and so does the content industry. It explodes when people are able to broadcast and create their own live dramas and sports. Virtual reality is more transformational than any technology before it. It becomes a drug, a virus, one far more deadly than Milong Fever was. In a way, I'm in the safest place in the world. No one here in prison contracted Milong Fever. None of us have ever been in a VR rig, never played the games, or enjoyed a show or an interactive drama. But I see what it does to the guards. You can tell who's a heavy user. The bloodshot eyes, weight loss, irritability. Nothing in the real world entertains them. The work is an agony they bear until they can get home and slip back into VR. It's like pictures I once saw of drug addicts, illustrating their physical deterioration from the first time they were arrested to the final arrest before they died. People wither away. Around the world, productivity plummets. Unemployment soars. Before, the world I saw on TV just looked like a run-down version of the one I left. Now it rots. Literally. No one wants to keep up the towns and homes where they live when they can escape to the world of their dreams with no effort. The ban on VR began at midnight Eastern Standard Time on a Tuesday. They shut it down at the routers. It was global, agreed upon in secret by every nation. Billions rose up in outrage. Riots ran through every town, city, and village on Earth. The governments tried to use the military and the police to maintain order, but 90% of them were addicted too. Millions died. They turned it all back on 6 hours later. It's been on since. I think it will be until the end. And they thought what I created was dangerous. A huge, hulking prisoner named Marcel leans into the laundry room.
Hi, Sinclair. You got a visitor?
For a long moment, I stand there holding the sheet, shocked. Alex. That's my first thought. He's forgiven me. I'm finally going to have a chance to say I'm sorry.
Who is it?
I ask, hoping and fearing the answer.
Man, I ain't your butler. Alvarez said tell you, and I did.
It's a little monotonous in prison. Arguing over trivial matters is a sort of pastime. It breaks the routine. Thanks, I mumble, as I race down the corridor. Pedro Alvarez is manning the check-in booth, sitting behind thick glass.
Doc, he says, picking up his tablet to check me in. Finally got one, huh?
I peer through the glass, scanning the room for Alex.
Better late than never.
That's right.
Keeping the kids off VR?
I ask.
My wife is. They're more scared of her.
He motions to the scan pad next to the door.
Clear.
The door seems to slide open in slow motion. I lean toward it, willing it to move. As soon as I can, I turn and slip through sideways. There are 40 or so people in the room, in groups of 2, 3, and 4, sitting on cheap plastic chairs around small coffee tables. A bank of vending machines covers the back wall, behind a yellow line on the floor that inmates can't cross. Visitors step past the line and scan their IDs and retrieve snacks that are truly a delicacy in this place. I wait, but Alex doesn't arrive. I walk back to the glass window of the guard booth.
Hey, Lieutenant, can you tell me who my visitor is?
He glances down at the tablet.
Dr. Lawrence Fowler,
Table 3. The name is vaguely familiar. Is he an attorney? Some justice project that wants to put me on a VR drama? That's the only way I'd get an appeal. A production team tried to drum up interest a few years ago, but it tested poorly with the sample audience. Fowler rises as I approach, offering his hand. Dr. Sinclair, I'm Lawrence Fowler. Thank you for seeing me. I don't get the attorney vibe from him, or VR entertainment industry. His suit is well worn but well taken care of. I'd guess civil servant, maybe scientist, maybe both. It takes me a minute to process what he said. I'm not sure how to react. Call me James. I haven't done much doctoring in a while. Not much science either. Yeah, I know the feeling. We sit and a long moment passes, Fowler apparently trying to organize his thoughts. He seems uncomfortable. I'm guessing he doesn't do a lot of federal prison visitation. He glances over at the inmate at the table beside us, munching on a chocolate bar, almost giddy. Do you want something to drink? A snack? I raise my hands and smile, surprised. No, I'm good. What can I do for you, Dr. Fowler? Please call me Lawrence. Okay. How would you like to get out of here, James? That sounds pretty good, I think. With that said, I'm just curious. How, why, and when? He smiles. I can't explain it all here. I can only tell you the when. He leans forward. Right now. That I didn't see coming. If I got the serial killer vibe from Fowler, I'd probably pass. My best guess? He represents some group that's going to put me in a weird medical experiment, off the books, probably burn my body. Maybe it's a Malong fever vaccine trial. But as I study Fowler's face, my doubts retreat. For whatever reason, I feel an instant trust with him. Well, as it turns out, right now is my favorite time to get out of prison. In the discharge room, I put my street clothes back on. It's strange at first. I feel like I stick out, as though I'm wearing a flashing neon sign. At the discharge desk, Fowler leans over, exposes his eye to the tablet's retinal scanner, and waits until it beeps. The sally port behind us slides open, and I glimpse the doors to the outside waiting beyond the lobby. You're all set, the guard mumbles before refocusing on his